So, welcome to the cars episode. That was a traffic jam, the likes of which we never encounter here in Two Harbors. We can be grateful for that.
Yes.
Yes. Welcome to Listener's Voices, the cars episode. I'm Fran, one of your hosts.
I'm Frances.
The other host, the co-host. Thank you for being here. So, we had some fun responses to this prompt this week, and it's amazing what some people remember about the cars of their lives, and other people are very selective about what they remember, and we'll have some good examples of both of those. Before we get into that, we do have a couple of belated responses to the generosity episode, and the format of the show, in case you're tuning in for the first time, we put out a prompt or an idea and ask people to respond in written or recorded to our email at ktwhwriters@gmail.com, and then we share them with you. So 2 weeks ago, we had an episode on unexpected generosity, and Katya Gordon made a submission, came in a little late, and so we're going to share that one with you right now.
This is Katya Gordon speaking to you about generosity. My story is a little different than I suspect most other ones because it's not about any specific person, but more generally a set of families. I grew up in a small town. It felt like a small town back then, near Philadelphia. Now it seems more like suburbia, but at the time it was a small town, and it was a religious community based on the writings of Emanuel Swedenborg, and called part of the New Church is what it was called, and still is called, actually. And there were several very, very wealthy families that were incredibly dedicated to building a whole school system and a church based on, for anyone who would espouses the writings of Emanuel Swedenborg. And so what that meant in practice is that we had an entire school system that was, I think at the time, virtually free to anyone who wanted to join. And it was a really wonderful school full of music and the arts. And I particularly remember, and then if you got to high school, it was also beautifully built high school with a beautiful gymnasium. And they actually, the history of it was that this family, the Pitcairn family, built a castle. Well, first they built the cathedral, which was the church we all worshiped in. And then they also built two castles behind it. This was during the Depression, and they were trying to employ people. And when they finished the cathedral, the Depression was not over, so they just kept going. And that's kind of the story. Of course, I don't really know a lot of the details behind it, but I do know that even when I was living there as a child in the 70s and 80s, the one thing that the family would do, I just know an older couple named Charlie, and what was her name? I don't remember his wife. They were deeply musical people and deeply in love with music. And if there were students at my school that showed a very strong aptitude for music, they would basically send them to music school, music lessons in music school, all the way up through conservatory, and several, international professional musicians now that are my peers are there because they were sent to conservatory basically by this incredibly wealthy family that wanted to spread music throughout the world. So that's my generosity story.
Thank you, Katya. Very different take on the subject, and very educational.
Yes.
Yeah, I knew the name Swedenborg, but I had no idea of that whole institution. We had one other late submission on that. Well, he didn't really intend it as a submission, but my story inspired my friend John out in Bellingham to recall a story of his. He said it's not on the scale of generosity of mine, but it's clearly moved him. And he has some foster grandchildren down in California. And I'll be interested to hear if you know of this place, Frances. So here's his story. Jeremy and I took Chumash Trail to Mugu Peak Trail, which provides an ocean view. Emily refers to actually Jeremy and Emily, his two foster grandchildren. Mugu Peak Trail is in Point Mugu State Park in the Santa Monica Mountains on the California coast.
Yes, I have heard of it.
Oh, okay. So two outstanding points, he says. Chumash Trail is 100% 25 to 30 degrees uphill, exhausting and, on the descent, dangerous for an older person. Mugu Peak Trail is very easy, with no incline. The second outstanding point, halfway up, a portly 50-year-old Hispanic saw that I was having balance problems, so he gave me his walking stick and told me, when I expressed concern that I might not see him again, to put it somewhere visible when I got back. I didn't know how to thank him, but he wasn't interested anyway. I didn't see him again and put it in a place that looked like others were using it for lost and found items. What got me about this guy was that he thought nothing of, in effect, giving away his walking stick to a total stranger, to a honky. Do you know what a honky is, Francis?
I believe
I
do.
Is it? So I had to look it up.
It's a reference to an old white person.
Right. Yeah, I think any non-white race won't use it to refer to the white people, and not in a, it's a kind of pejorative, right?
In this regard, I don't suppose he's trying to be pejorative, but maybe saying that there's differences between them.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't expect somebody that of a different background to have been so generous to him.
Right. Yeah. So, thank you, John. So that's, for now, all the generosity stories we have, but people are still welcome to send them in.
Keep them coming.
Yeah. And any of our previous prompts. We will give you a heads up. We've always been saying all of our shows are archived on the web, on our website, under the, well, ktwh.org, under the programs drop-down. There's a listener's voices tab. It's this is episode 38 now, and we decided we can't really be taking up all that space on the website. We're the only show that has every program ever archived. So pretty soon we will be having only the past 6 months at the most archived, and we will actually start alternating our new shows with instead of alternating with the polka show, which might take people aback when they tune in thinking they're going to hear listeners' voices. We will start at the beginning of our shows and do reruns of our previous episodes on the alternate weeks. That was a really good idea.
That way you'll still get listeners' voices, whether it's an on week or an off week.
Right. Yep. Yeah. So, great idea. So, Anne, maybe this would be a good time also to give people a heads up on what the next prompt will be. Yeah, we put it out in an email early to the people on our email list, and you can get on our email list at that same address, ktwhwriters@gmail.com, because of the holiday season and people not having as much time. So we gave you an early one on this. But listeners, if they're not on that list, may not have been aware yet. So,
right.
Yeah.
So get on the list, and you get early notice when we give it.
Yeah, early notice. But we can tell you now, too.
So the show is going to air on January 4th, and the topic given is gratitude, reciprocity, and community. I've gotten a little bit of pushback from the people I've been speaking to.
Oh.
They want it to either be gratitude or community. So you can choose whichever one or all three. You get bonus points for using all three topics in the same response.
Mm-hmm. That would be a challenge.
And we're going to take submissions until December 30th.
Oh.
Because I have people coming into town.
Oh.
And I only have one or two days to prep for that. So.
Okay, that's good to know.
And we have New Year's Eve, so.
Right, yeah.
Aaron,
I was making sure that we didn't make it Wednesday because, in fact, it does say that. That's what it's going to say in the paper, I guess, is Wednesday.
Oh, it can say that. But anybody listening, you know, I'm going to try to get people to submit a little bit early. We do give you 2 weeks to think and write now, not just one.
Uh-huh.
So if you can, I would appreciate it.
And I know of people who've known of this week's prompt for 2 weeks, and they still are recording it as we speak
this
somewhere
evening,
else in
sometime.
Town. Yes. You know who you are.
And, you know, if it is late, we will include it in the following show. So there is no harm, no foul. Mm-hmm. But we do like getting your participation. We do like hearing it in your voice. So please send us your responses to gratitude, reciprocity, and community, and or.
Right. Yeah. So, okay, that will be something to look forward to. So the cars one had some fun responses, and I thought that maybe we would sort of do it in a roughly chronological order, at least for starting out. Then the may go all over the place because I don't even know what a couple of the submissions are yet. But
and how do you figure chronological?
So the oldest cars happens to be probably the oldest person submitting and talking about some cars that go way back with wooden wheels and wooden spokes.
My.
Yeah. But first, we're going to hear a little lesson in motor car vocabulary. And I can't even remember where I found this. Probably on the Internet Archive, I think. And so it's a part of a series that's made for English language learners. And so this is teaching you about English vocabulary for cars, also especially English speakers. It's quite apparently done in England for people learning there because it's an
British
accent.
British speaking English.
Right, that's what I mean. Thank you. Yep. So we'll hear just a little bit of this, not the whole 3 minutes maybe, but it's kind of fun.
Lesson 28. The 28th lesson. The motor car. Everybody drives a car nowadays, and it's just as well to be familiar with the vocabulary of motoring, because you may want something done to your car when you're touring. The large closed car in the picture is a 6-cylinder, 20-horsepower saloon. The small car is a 2-seater with the hood up, a useful little car. She does over 35 miles to the gallon. Examine them closely and learn the names of the various parts. Chassis, body, bonnet, wheels, tires, hood, radiator, engine, steering wheel, and so on. The gear lever and the brake are in the middle. Some people prefer a right-hand change. The spare wheel is on the back of the car. It comes in very handy when you get a puncture and have to change a wheel on the road. The windscreen is in one piece. Personally, I prefer a 2-piece windscreen. The small car is a 2-seater with a large dickey. The petrol tank of the large car is at the back. It holds 14 gallons. The driver has just drawn up at a garage to get some petrol and to change a plug. He's been having trouble with the engine, misfiring and pulling badly. He's going to get some petrol from the pump. Don't forget, when you are driving in England, to keep always on the left-hand side. Pass on the left, overtake on the right, and whatever you do, obey the policeman's signal. Never argue with a policeman. It doesn't pay. You'll only get the worst of the argument.
Good advice. Depending on the circumstance.
Can you imagine trying to learn English and thinking that you've taken the right lessons and then speaking British English
here
in a country that doesn't?
Right. Yeah. Talking about the bonnet and the
the dickie. What is a dickie?
Yeah, I have no idea. And the windscreen, of course, is the windshield. But yeah, I thought that was kind of fun. So we had Bill Berg in here this afternoon to record his submission. And so this is starting back. This is, well, actually, I was talking about this episode with Moose the other night here in the station, and he asked me what the oldest car was that I, in my life. And I was thinking of cars that I've owned, and I'll talk more about that later. But and then I was reminded of some others, but Bill by far takes the cake for oldest cars in his memory, and we'll hear about that now, some of his father's and then ones that he owned himself.
I had sent in a little bit of memories about automobiles and old cars and trucks earlier, but since then I've thought of a couple earlier ones going back to post-World War II. And a couple of those ideas are my dad got out of the Army not till early 1947, and he was looking around for a car, and cars are really rare then post-World War II. And his first car post-World War II was a 1931 Oldsmobile. And it had wooden spokes and wooden wheels, you know, and it was just a neat car, and it was the kind of a car where a seven-year-old could stand up in and just open the windows and hang out. And it was that big a neat a car. And that lasted a couple of years, and then Dad bought a 1930. He went backwards a year, but a really luxurious car called a Willie's Knight. And it was a long car, again, with a crank start if you needed it, just like the Oldsmobile was. If it didn't start, you cranked it with a hand crank by the bumper. And, again, wooden wheels. And it had an unusual engine called a sleeve valve engine. And only a good mechanic would really know what that was about. And then Dad's next car was a Nash. I believe it was a 1950 Nash. And Nashes were popular, especially with younger couples, because they had seats that would fold into a bed. Well, now we'll get into cars that I've owned, and there are some pretty neat ones, and something pretty interesting about most of the cars, these old cars, they don't make them anymore. You know, no more Willys, no more Nash, no more a lot of these. One of Dad's early cars, again, was a 1950 DeSoto, and that was a pretty neat car, and again, they don't make them anymore. It had fluid drive in it. You could shift it, or you could just leave it in third gear, and it would go. And I took my driver's test in that car, and about halfway through the exam, the examiner yelled, "Stop, stop, pull over right now," and I did. And he says, "You've flunked this test royally, and take us back to where we started, and you flunked royally, because you went through every single stop sign that there was." And he asked who gave your driver's lessons, and I says, "My dad." And but then I went to a driver's instructor in high school, and I finally took another test, and everything was okay. So the lesson there is, don't take driver's lessons from your dad. Well, the first car I actually owned was a 1948 Plymouth four-door, three on the floor, painted gray, with running boards and a sun visor. Dad was against me driving and always said, "In Sweden, everyone rides bikes all their lives, and why can't you?" Well, in 1957, I finally bought this Plymouth, and even Dad envied the upholstery, which is mohair, a really neat older upholstery. But after a while, I needed something better, and I saved enough money with my paper out to buy a beautiful 1952 two-tone green Chevy with sun visor and power glide. It was not a drag racer, but it was a fair passion wagon. It sometimes had a grinding sound in the rear end, and the mechanic said he wouldn't drive it around the block. But another mechanic said, "Put in a pint of STP in the rear end." And I drove that car for more than 250,000 miles that way. While in the Army, several trips to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and Fort Carson, Colorado, took their toll on that car. The mountains in Colorado were a little tough on that tiny six-cylinder engine. And the day came when three of us were discharged at the same time, and stuff tied to the top and loaded heavy. The Chevy had a hard time making it up the smallest grade. And in Kansas, a highway patrolman towed us up the smallest hill you could imagine and wished us well. We stopped at a Plymouth dealer in southwestern Minnesota, and the mechanic said he could tighten the valves. It would ruin the engine, but we'd get home. So I dropped my friends off, my army friends off in Zumbrota, and drove home, and I parked it in front of Mom and Dad's house, and the car never ran again. I had saved enough money in the army to buy a new car. So the very next day, Dad and I went, and we bought a beautiful 1964 Plymouth Savoy with three on the column and a slant six engine. The cost was $2,300, and I still have the receipt, believe it or not. And our family of six drove in that car for 291,000 miles, all trouble-free, and the gal we gave it to drove it for many more. Well, there are many others, like the 1938 Dodge Brothers, a year before they joined Chrysler, pickup that I had, and we used that for many, many years, and the 1941 Ford pickup that I had, that had vapor lock, and when hot, it would not start. And the 1950 Willys 4x4 station wagon that I sold to a fellow in Florida because of its rarity, and he repaired that and looks beautiful. Maybe another time we can talk about this some more, like all the pictures that I have in my new car brochures from the 1930s cars, and also lots of old 1930s magazines with great car ads in them. This is fun stuff, isn't it? Thank you. Bye-bye.
Again, that was Bill Burke. And yes, I can imagine another Cars episode coming up, because I'll bet you these stories and more you'll hear still are going to be stimulating memories in lots of listeners' minds.
If he still has a receipt from a car that he purchased in the 50s,
yeah,
then, and magazines of times gone by, I wonder what else he has. Stores and stores of history stuff.
Yeah, yep, I'll
gonna
bet.
Have to...
Yeah, he even knew when B was here this afternoon, he had it down to the cent of the price of that car.
Do you remember what it was?
No, I don't. It was pretty, not, it was just some cents, a number of cents over $2,300. And I can't remember if there are any more dollars, but I was really impressed.
Yes.
And the whole episode, there's more to come, obviously, but really made an impression on me how intimately our lives, for a lot of people, some people maybe don't have this feeling, but how connected our cars are to the different chapters of our lives or different people or different places we've lived.
Everybody I know is very intimately attached to their cars.
Yeah, and know the history, can remember the history of all their cars.
The order of cars that they've had, the travels they've had on them, or adventures even.
Uh-huh.
Misadventures and...
Yeah, so I thought I would follow his with mine because my cars go back not as far as his, but no wooden wheels and spokes, but... So when Moose asked me the other night about the oldest car in my memory, and I thought of the oldest one I've owned personally was 1959 VW Bug, I think. But then I later realized, well, there were the ones I grew up with, and the earliest that I remembered was a green Pontiac. My brother reminded me or informed me that it would be called a slant back. It just was very tapered from the back over the trunk and so forth. It was a 1950. And it had been our grandmother's, and we acquired it. He said it's an uncommon straight eight-cylinder engine. So that's pretty unique, I guess.
It can go.
Yeah.
Could go.
And then that my grandmother would have this eight-cylinder.
They built cars a little bit more powerful and
yeah,
to
I
last.
Guess so. But then he also reminded me, well, he didn't remind me because I didn't remember this, but the car that I would have come home from the hospital in was a 1948 Dodge, a dark red 1948 Dodge. And I'm impressed that we had a brand new car at that time, because I was born in 1948, and my goodness, it was a new car in the family. So that went with us to Minneapolis when we moved to Minneapolis in 1954, and then somewhere along the way we acquired Grandma's Pontiac, the slant-back Pontiac. And then I don't know if this was new or not. We, after that, had a 1956 fire engine red Chevy V8, and I can visualize that one very well. Richmond later is going to talk about a Chevy on that era, and I'll be interested to hear again now which year his was. They might have been the same. Yeah, and I'm not going to go through every car I ever owned, but this is just going back to my early life and that I can remember these little details. My mother bought a brand new Chevy Nova in either 65 or 66, and was a hard bargainer, I guess. Got it for a really good price, whatever that was. I have no idea, but she was kind of known for that. And that ended up being my first car. I kind of acquired it from her in about 1970. And then the first one that I bought myself with my roommate was the 59 VW Bug. And that's the one that you've heard about in an earlier episode, the Goat Mobile, that we carried, ferried goats back down to southwestern Wisconsin and then even more goats on the way back. So then I will just mention one other one. Sometime in the late 1970s, I purchased a 1963 Ford pickup, old rusty. It had an engine that motorheads seemed to covet. I think it was maybe a 283, which doesn't mean anything to me, but when people would hear that, they'd say, whoa, wow. I think this is four-cylinder, three gears on the floor, three on the floor, 17-inch tires that had chain, came with chains, although they had split rims, and that's a very dangerous thing. I don't think they are even available anymore, but when you go to repair them, the spring may come flying off of the wheel and do serious injury. A huge steering wheel and a big, long shift lever, and it was just so much fun to drive. As a coworker once said of it when we were together there going somewhere, he said, oh, an animal. And I thought at first he was referring to another coworker that we'd been talking about behind his back. But I was relieved to realize he was talking about my truck. Old Rusty came in very handy when I was building my cabin. And the simplicity of the engines of that generation was just a beautiful thing. I could half crawl into the engine space with very compact components. So I changed out the entire fuel supply chain in that, as everything except the fuel tank itself. And I still have this relic. If anyone wants to make an offer, I can show it to you.
I might just look at it.
Oh, okay. It still has the split rims. But last I looked, the tires all have air still. And but it's very airy. Somebody, I think maybe Leslie will be talking about. No, was it Leslie? Maybe. being able to see the road through the floor. or through below the side doors, below the doors, yeah. But, yeah, we'll look and we'll follow up on that later.
Speaking of seeing the floor through the road through the floor, mm-hmm. I used to work at a vineyard, Long Island, and we had a vineyard mobile, and it was a Volkswagen Bug, mm-hmm. and the floors were completely gone. Mm-hmm. You had to put your feet up on the sides.
Wow.
And drive through the field.
Wow, yeah. So I thought, hearing about everybody's stick shift, what's the other name for that?
Manual.
Manual transmission, right. Just makes me really nostalgic for a manual transmission car. They are not easy to find anymore. I don't know when I've driven one. But Judy's story is a lot about that. And we'll hear from Judy next.
This is Judy, and I'm responding to the prompt about cars. I was living in California when I bought my first car. In fact, I didn't get my driver's license until I moved to California at the age of 29. The first 2 years there, I had the use of a car, a big black station wagon. In 1969, I needed to buy my own car. I didn't have a job at that point, but had a friend who was willing to co-sign for me, so I started looking. Another friend had advised me earlier to consider buying a Saab, as they had a good reputation. I found a little red used Saab at a dealer's and decided to try it out. The only problem was that it was a manual shift, and although I had driven one a few times, I was more used to and comfortable with an automatic transmission. The dealer suggested that I take it out for a trial drive. The friend who had come with me and I set out driving. He knew how to drive a manual shift car, so he was able to coach me, but of course I constantly killed the motor. Finally, we made it back to the dealer's, and I took the plunge. The dealer suggested that I take the car and drive it for a week, then decided if I wanted to keep it. The drive back to my apartment was like a nightmare, killing the engine every time I had to stop for a light or stop sign. Finally, I arrived home and breathed a sigh of relief, with many doubts as to if I would ever learn to drive this cute little car. Well, I did. When the week was up, I decided I was ready to buy my first car. I contacted my co-signing friend. We got all the paperwork completed, and it was mine. Soon I had a job and was able to start paying him back. By the time I left California 2 years later, I had finished repaying him and took off driving across the country to start a master's program at Syracuse University. I kept that little red Saab for 9 years, and we had many adventures together. Finally, it needed a lot of repair. I sold it to someone who saw it in a parking lot at a store and left a note on it asking me to contact him if I ever wanted to sell it. He was very happy to get it for a friend who collected Saabs, and I was in the process of buying a Volkswagen Rabbit, another manual shift car, now that I had become an expert.
Okay, thank you, Judy. I think you're not driving a manual transmission car anymore that I know of. Judy shares a car. And
it's hard to find them now. All of my cars were manual until the last two, and I did not have a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, it's a sad thing. But glad you at least mastered that skill, Judy. So we're going to shift gears a little bit here. Ha, ha, ha. Kids out. I didn't even plan that. Patrick has a story that kind of a nightmare that we all dread here living in the Northland. And so we will hear about that next right now.
Seemed like a simple enough thing to do. I had done it 100 times. I had to get a jump on the battery of the car earlier today, so I knew the temperature was dropping fast. But at 1 a.m., the car started right up, and it was time to ride back from Duluth to my home in Clover Valley. A simple thing. I've done it 100 times. I decided to take the back roads under the bright light of the waning moon. There was little traffic in town and none as I turned off the Jean Duluth Road heading toward French River. I thought it peculiar that the temperature gauge barely rose above the cold mark on the car, but everything seemed to be in the best of order. I probably should have gotten gas in town, but there was at least enough to get home. I had banked an armload of well-cured maple in the wood stove before I left that afternoon, and I should arrive home with it still nice and warm. A bed of coals on which to rekindle a fire. I was dressed adequately, pack boots, long johns, snow pants, sweater, and a good winter coat, a thick wool stocking cap on my head, and my fleece-lined mittens wrapped around the steering wheel. The late-night radio coming from the speakers sounded real nice, and the moon-soaked landscape had a crystal, dreamlike quality. Everything was fine. I'd be home in no time at all. Simple. About 2 miles from the North Shore School, the car started to miss and chug, and then it stalled out completely, red lights coming on in the dashboard, the heater fan purring, and the radio played on. Yipes. I turned the key, and the engine turned over smoothly and started. I breathed a sigh of relief, put it in gear, and I drove about 15 yards, and then it stalled again. Oh, no. I closed the choke and stepped on the gas, turned the key, and the car started. I hopefully put in the clutch engaged first gear and slowly let the clutch out and began to move. Another 10 yards and the car stalled again. Frantically, I turned the key. The car roared to life and stalled immediately. I turned the key and the engine turned over and over, but it failed to start. I snapped off the lights, the heater fan, turned off the radio, and turned the key again. Turned over and over and over, fired for a moment, and then stalled again. I pulled the hood latch, and I stepped out of the car. There wasn't much wind, but it had a bite. It must have been very cold. I did not want to think about walking since I was still about 12 miles from home. I had forgotten the flashlight, and the cold indifference of the moon revealed no answers as I stood looking at that cold engine. Slamming the hood down, I hurried back to the car seat, and the interior was getting cold, the windows traced with frost. I grabbed the key and turned it. Choke closed, the engine roared to life. I engaged the gear and said a little prayer and eased out the clutch. Another 20 yards and it stalled. Turning off the lights, I took a deep breath and suddenly everything was quiet. The countryside seemed ominous. There were no lights nearby. The moon was indifferent. And I was tired, and the cold began to feel as if it were finding its way in, even under my layers of clothing. It seemed to be a dangerous situation, and I wasn't sure what to do. The trees were black against the horizon, the snow illuminated under the moon and the stars. There was no sound other than the wind blowing around the stalled car. I leaned my forehead on the steering wheel and shut my eyes, only able to wish there was a sound and warmth or another car on this lonely night road. I'm not sure how long I sat there, swallowed in a helpless silence. A shiver ran through me and I looked up. When I took hold of the key and I turned it, the car started. I pulled away and drove for about 2 miles this time and stalled again. It was like that until I got home. I had to wait 5 to 20 minutes between my 1 or 2 mile spurts of power to get there. Finally, I was on my driveway, car in third gear going as fast as I dared up the hill and around the corner. Then, turning off the car, I immediately jumped out. The moon had moved across the sky, and I said a prayer of thanks.
Thank you, Patrick. Wow. like I said, everybody's nightmare
right
around here. Yeah. Yep. So I came upon a story looking at stories about cars this week. This is an anonymous contributor from outside of our area. But when I heard, I can't remember which I saw first. I think I'd heard Patrick's story and then came upon this and thought, oh, this is a good one to follow that up with. So would you read that for us, Frances?
Certainly. It was a snowy winter night in 1972. I was 17 years old and had just left Moscow, Idaho, where I was attending my first year of college. The wind drove huge flakes into the windshield of my 1952 VW Beetle, a high school graduation present from my parents. Dad had traded a deer rifle for it, and he and my younger brother had spray-painted it school bus yellow. The snow was so heavy, I had a hard time telling the road from the field along the highway. But I just had to drive 30 miles home to Lewiston to see my high school girlfriend, as I had been doing every weekend. She was my first love. I had experience driving in snow. Dad had taken me to big parking lots in the winter and made me practice skidding. And I trusted my little yellow bug to get me through. About 15 miles from Lewiston, though, the wipers stopped working. Unable to see through the snow-covered windshield, I stopped in the middle of the road, hoping that if a car came by from behind me, it wouldn't hit me. Now I was scared. I didn't know how to fix the wiper motor. At least I had a blanket and food in the car. My dad again. Then I remembered that I'd left my ice skates behind the back seat. I removed the long laces, tied one lace to each wiper blade, then ran them both through the side windows, knotted them together, and I moved the blades back and forth with one hand while I steered with the other. It worked. I could see just well enough to get to my girlfriend's house. I had known I was lesbian since 7th grade, but at this point I had told almost no one. The only person with whom I felt safe was my girlfriend. I would gladly have driven through 100 snowstorms to see her. My dad died last summer at the age of 84. He was never able to accept me being gay, but the driving skills he taught me and the gift of that old Volkswagen were the keys to my freedom.
So I love the ingenuity of that.
Oh,
the skate laces.
I would never have thought about laces and manually wiping.
Yeah, me either.
I would have been frozen to death.
I seem to remember something about kind of manual windshield wiper operation, but it was with a knob on the inside.
Yes.
Right. It wasn't built
to be
that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that is catastrophic. If you can't see out the windshield, you're not going very far.
Right. Yep. Yeah. So I thought that was ingenious. And then just the role of learning to drive in relationships.
Maybe that's why cars are so important to us, because they do indeed enable us to have freedom to go places, to have jobs, to see other places.
And how the impact or the influence of whoever teaches you on the rest of your driving life. Well, that ingenuity that writer showed with that in that story made me think of Leslie's story, because she'll tell us about her car and the many miles it went. And I think this may be the one where eventually you could see through the floor, but we'll listen and see. This is from Leslie Black.
My Tennis Shoe Car by Leslie. I was in my late 40s when I completed my 4-year Bachelor of Science in Music Ed and began preparing to move from my 40-acre hobby farm near Park Rapids, Minnesota, to Illinois University in Champaign-Urbana for a teaching assistantship and master's degree. I had been living with my son on that acreage and commuted for 3.5 years to Bemidji State U, about 50 miles away, for that degree. Aside from the old two-banger International Harvester I own, another story altogether, my everyday vehicle had been an older 6-cylinder pickup truck. I began looking for a small, inexpensive used car to buy and tow behind my U-Haul to Illinois. A fellow down the road with an auto repair shop next to his rural house said he had a vehicle with a new rebuilt engine and it could be available in a week after his son completes the new paint job. It was an adorable little Chevette on the outside with Nike-esque designs on both sides, a 4-cylinder that purred like a kitten, but sheet metal floors to keep the rain out and duct tape to hold up the ceiling upholstery. For $1,000, though, Junior had sold me a great little gas saver. After our move to Illinois, I bought an old but low-mileage Honda and gave the Chevette to my high school-age son. He had already nicknamed it the Tennis Shoe because of the Nike-look paint job. Caleb was a taxi driver for so many boys, and the vehicle endured many mishaps. Sliding into a ditch on our icy flat road into town was an especially frequent winter occurrence. Not a huge problem, because down the road, my son had a friend with a pickup and winch. One icy day down the lane, Caleb slid into the ditch and couldn't get a hold of his friend. The two of us couldn't push enough to get it back up when he called on friends, and the four of them lifted it with ease back onto the road. Flat tire repair was then needed, and that's all. Another time after my teenager had been doing donuts in the road, he flipped it over on its roof. Again, he and friends flipped it right back, right side up and back onto the road. Poor little tennis shoe had its rear view mirror broken and hanging, roof dented, and several scratches. My son learned to maintain his car with oil changes, doing minor repairs, tire checks, and all that. But on the outside, within a year, the Chevette looked like a big dog had chewed on that little tennis shoe. That new rebuilt engine kept running beautifully, though. More and more sheet metal and duct tape kept that car on the road for at least a few more years. Caleb took some auto mechanics in high school and grew up to have a successful career in auto sales for Kia of Duluth and now Luther in Burnsville. Much to his disappointment, my son knows that I have been a Subaru fan from my first new 1998 Outback to my current 2019 Star Trek, Cross Trek.
Thank you, Leslie. Wow. So, yeah, it had a long, good life, and I totally relate to the duct tape holding things up. And it's not the holes in the floor. Maybe we'll still get to that with Richmond, but it had a hard life, but...
Well, I remember having a car that could also be picked up and taken out of a parking spot, put back on the road so you could take off. No longer, I don't think you can find cars like that.
Was that a VW Bug?
It was.
Of course, yes. Yeah, I don't remember if we ever had to do that with mine, but that sounds familiar. So we have some fun songs to throw in here, but we better make sure we get Richmond's in before the end of the show. So we will hear from Richmond and a little follow-up to that.
Hello, this is Richmond responding to the prompt Cars and Pickups. Over a period of 55 years, figured I've owned about 15 or more automobiles and a pickup truck or two. Some were memorable. First car owned, paid for with $100 my own money, a late 1950s white Rambler station wagon. Model unknown, rattle trap, rust bucket. There's not much more to tell. It wasn't memorable other than it was my first. The second set of four wheels with a horn engine and trunk was more fun. A 1960 Ford Falcon Black, good runner, little rust, standard transmission, three-speed shifter on the steering column. My next-door neighbor Ben sold me it. How much, I don't recall. What I do remember were the difficulties learning to drive that stick-shift automobile. Eventually, I learned the proper coordination, relaxing the clutch whilst feathering down the accelerator, shifting gears up and down, down and up. But it took some time. Recalling the neighborhood bank drive-through teller, the bank's paved asphalt road led up a hill and incline of some pitch to the drive-through teller's window. Hoping to make a deposit with one car up ahead, I drove up that pitchy hill, stopping a few feet back of that car, whilst another pulled up behind with a couple of feet between us. Boxed in, no way out I was. Feeling pretty anxious with getting the combination of clutch and acceleration proper to not lunging forward hitting the vehicle in front or stalling the engine to roll back hitting the vehicle behind. First try, popped the clutch and stalled. Second try, lurched abruptly forward. Thankfully, the vehicle in front had finished their banking and moved on. Another day, sunny with summer. I recall being in another line of cars going to that teller on the hill in a different car, this time Star Mist Blue, 1957 Ford Fairlane, with white side panels and fins, automatic transmission, powered by a respectable V8. My grandmother Nanny gave me that car. 5 years previous, she'd decided she was no longer safe to drive and stored it in her garage. Then on my 17th birthday, she gave me that beautiful automobile. What a thrill to drive that vintage 11-year-old automobile in pristine condition. Back to being in line at the bank. A song I'd never heard came on the radio. Give Me a Head with Hair by the Cowsills. Give me a head with hair, long, beautiful hair. shining, gleaming, streaming, flaxen, waxen. That song gave me goosebumps up and down my spine. That's my first memory of the car given to me by my grandmother Nanny. Give me a head with hair. 20 cents a gallon and 14 miles per gallon. A few friends pitching in a dollar or two would get us around 15 miles of cruising on a Saturday night. From Coon Rapids to destinations of Anoka, Blaine, Osseo, Champlain, Ham Lake, Spring Lake Park, all third-tier Minneapolis suburbs of the late 1960s. Not yet developed, they had lots of open roads. Riding with friends, drinking Coca-Cola, cranking out tunes on the AM dial star 57 car radio. So much fun, except when my dad checked the odometer the following day to assess the miles consumed the night before. Well, things did not bode well for Star Mist Blue 1957 Ford Fairlane. Dad would go on about my putting on so many miles, while many times reminding me to check the oil before each drive, which sometimes I did, and oftentimes did not. Wouldn't you know it, Star Mist Blue 1957 developed an oil leak, and the engine froze up from lack of it. Locked up solid, you can hear my dad's words. Happy he was not. But we fixed it, pulled all 8 spark plugs, and in each cylinder injected penetrating oil. Then over a period of days, weeks maybe, just kept working the fan on the engine block back and forth till finally it freed up. That is all I remember of the day's driving Star Mist Blue 57. Next came another blue Ford, a 1959 Comet two-door, auto transmission, Wedgwood blue. Dad was real proud of that car. So was I. It was clean, like new, low miles, good tires. I think he got a good price, as it was in an accident. Maybe it had been repaired. Being still in high school, 17 years old, and though not yet on the title, it was soon to be my car, car number 4. Yet, as I was to learn, car number 4, Wedgwood Blue, was accident prone.
So this goes out, especially to Richmond. It's called 64 Ford Fairlane. I couldn't find a song called 57 Ford Fairlane, but
he had some sweet rides.
Yeah, yep. And I'm thinking maybe that this is all there is to it. I think that is maybe what their Ford Fairlane sounded like.
Or it was a jazzy car.
Well, that could be, yeah. That's from Calexico, I guess, is the name of the group, and Aero Calexico was the name of the album. So, yeah, you left us hanging there, Richmond. That last car was accident-prone. Oh, boy. Yeah.
To be continued in Car 2.0.
Yes, the next episode of Cars, whenever that happens. So we will shoehorn Becky's submission here in the end of the show once we get it. Okay, here it is, Becky's submission, and it comes full circle back to the beginning of the show with a couple belated generosity contributions, because this doubles as both a car submission and a generosity submission.
This is Becky in Two Harbors. I have something about cars, and it's a generosity story, so it fits with the previous theme. I did not get my driver's license until I was well into my 30s. That's another story, how that happened. And there was some real generosity involved in me getting it. Several friends who helped me practice and loaned me their car to go take the test twice. And when I finally managed it, my great aunt gave me a car. Auntie Violet and her brother, Uncle Kenneth, took care of their mother, and then they took care of their older sister, and then they took care of each other. They lived in Winona, and we would go visit them often when I was a kid. Uncle Kenneth had a stroke. He was the driver. I don't know if Auntie Violet still had a license, but she really had not been driving much, if at all. So when he had a stroke and he was done driving, she was done with the car. And when she heard that I had gotten my license, finally, she decided I should have the car. So in the summer of 1990, I took the train from St. Paul, where I was living, down to Winona, and drove back. What a thrill. While I was there, I took her for a drive so she could see how my driving was. And when we went to the DMV to transfer the title, they asked what the price was, and she said $1. It was a red Ford Fairmont. I can't remember the year. I'm thinking about 1981. That car served me very well for several years until I decided that I wasn't going to put any more money into fixing it and got something a little newer. It was a lovely start to driving and a very generous gift to help me get going.
Thank you, Becky. So speaking of coming full circle back to the generosity episode, we do also want to repeat the prompt for the next episode of Listener's Voices, which will air January 4th. That prompt is gratitude, reciprocity, and or community. Do you have a story of gratitude? Do you value reciprocity? And or what importance does community play in your life? Francis would appreciate responses to that by Monday, December 30th, if possible. And that show will air on January 4th, as I said. I think we will try to go out here with, I don't know how much of this song will make it in the end of the broadcast, but it'll probably sound familiar to many of you, and we'll hear from Johnny Cash to take us out here.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by, and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, 'cause I always wanted me one that was long and black. One day I devised myself a plan that should be the envy of most any man. I'd sneak it out of there in a lunchbox in my hand. Now getting caught meant getting fired, but I figured I'd have it all by the time I retired. I'd have me a car worth at least $100,000. I'd get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime. You'll know it's me when I come through your town.